All righty, to all of our automotive enthusiast friends and podcast listeners from around the planet Earth, prepare to hopefully enjoy yet another...
another confabulated episode of V8 Radio, Kevin.
Confabulated.
Yes.
Outstanding. I think that's like three words in one, isn't it?
It is. It is, pretty much. I think I pick up a word here, I pick up a word there. Sometimes I mash them together. We make words.
Yeah, it's confab and ulated.
Yes. Yes. Meaning to meaning engage to... in conversation.
Can you use that in a sentence, please?
Kevin and I confabulated about the show.
Wow. So we engaged in a conversation.
Yes.
Or we confabulated.
Correctamundo.
None of that to me in the, what is it, the etymology of the word sounds like it has anything to do with having a conversation.
Yeah. What can I tell you?
Yeah,
the
but
words
that's
come,
just,
the words go.
It's just how this show goes too.
Pretty much.
You are listening to VA Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Oostie, joined as always by our esteemed co-host, the confabulated Mike Hubal Clark. And we've got a lot happening on this particular episode, so I hope you're ready.
Well, we sure have. We probably won't have as big a trivia question as we had last time.
I hope not for our listeners, or they're going to confabulate against us.
Bonus for proper use of the word confabulate, Kevin.
Yeah, right. Well, as you alluded to, on every episode of V8 Radio, we start off with a trivia question, usually automotive in genre. And we ask it in the beginning and answer it at the end. And that way it completes the circle of trivia life all in one shot.
So have meta. You, love it.
Have you prepared a trivia question for this episode?
Absolutely. Yes, sir. And let's have it. So, all right, Kevin, there's a lot of fast cars out there.
Sure is. Sure are.
One car in particular was so fast, it actually broke the sound barrier. What car was that?
That is fast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say...
I mean, I loosely use the term car, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. Something, I'm going to guess it's something with wheels on the ground.
Correct.
Right. I'm going to say that was the land speed record holder, I think to this day, known as the Blue Flame.
The Blue Flame?
Which was sponsored by the natural gas industry and driven by a guy named Gary Gebelik, who... I believe broke the sound barrier in 1970 or so in that thing. It's actually built in a shop in Wisconsin, of all places. If it's the right car. If it's the right car, yeah.
All right. Kevin says Blue Flame. All right. And you said it was done in the 70s. Bonus question for you if you can tell me when it happened.
I think 1970. Yeah. Now, there is a possibility that another land speed car has beaten that, because I know the Brits and the U.S. were going back and forth in the 90s and early 2000s, I think, with the land speed record going back and forth. But I think that was a different class. I think the Blue Flame might still be the fastest one. Otherwise, my alternate answer is it's a different car. How about that?
Hedging your bets. I love it. Very nice. All right. So duly noted, sir. Blue Flame for the bonus 1970. Got it.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but we'll find out.
All right. But you know what I know about is...
What's that?
I got last episode's trivia question correct, and I got the one before that correct.
You're on a roll.
That makes two in a row, Kevin.
Yeah.
One more, and that's called a winning streak.
Three strikes and you're out is what
that is. So the ball's in your court if you want to let this happen for the first time in V8 radio history. That's all I'm saying. I'm just laying it out there.
Hey, I'm all for you being a winner.
Right on.
In everything.
Mm-hmm. Dig it.
And with that, let me throw this one out at you.
Okay.
In the early 60s, our friends at Pontiac built some interesting cars. One of them, I believe the Le Mans and the Tempest, had a unique two-speed automatic transmission that was mounted in the rear of the vehicle. Uh-huh. And a transaxle arrangement. Uh-huh. Stamped on this case, I believe it actually says Power Glide, because it shared the internals with the Chevrolet Power Glide two-speed transmission.
Okay.
But our friends at Pontiac, they can't have a Chevrolet name on one of their parts.
Absolutely not.
So what did they call the rear mount two-speed automatic transmission found in the 63 Pontiac?
Well, Kevin, yeah, like you said, that 63 Pontiac Le Mans and Tempest had that rear transaxle, and it was the drive shaft was actually curved, and it was called the rope drive, if I remember correctly. But that mm-hmm. that's not what you're asking me. You're asking me what the name of the transaxle unit was, and what Pontiac called it.
Right.
And man, I was so close to a winning streak.
Wait, no, you can't give up now. You're almost there.
Yeah. Pontiac called that the Super Turbine 300.
The Super Turbine 300. Interesting name for a transmission.
Isn't it, though? Isn't it? I know they called their rear, their limited slip diffs, the safety track. That was their marketing term for a
safety track.
Safety track. But the term posi is pretty much used universally, which was a Chevrolet term.
Right. Yeah, everybody calls it that. Mm-hmm. As opposed to a Ford Sure Grip and all that stuff.
Correct. Right, right.
So you think it was the Super Turbine 300?
Super Turbine 300.
That's that your I'm final saying. Answer?
Final answer, sir. Lock in the votes.
All right. Duly noted. And I'm going to have to ask you to maybe remember that, because as I usually type these on my computer screen is frozen.
Oh, no.
So.
Okay. Well, here's what we'll do. You're going to tell me what the answer is, and I'm going to tell you no. And I'm going to tell you if that's what I wrote down or not.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think it's coming back. Hold on.
I wrote it down. It's all right.
I can do the Super Turbine 300. All right. Duly noted. For sure this time. So there's a lot happening in the world of cars right now, and I've got a couple of news items that I thought were interesting just to touch on real quick.
Cool.
One of them is, I don't know if you heard this past week, Porsche was actually kicking around the idea of manufacturing in China.
Get out of town, really?
Yeah, get out of Stuttgart.
Get out of Stuttgart. Ah, dang it.
Yeah, that's apparently their second biggest market, I think, is in China at this point. They're selling... Okay. A lot of Porsche in the China.
Really?
Yeah, so they thought, why not make them here? And interestingly, that thought did not last long. And they said,
really?
Yeah, you know what? The reason why these cars are Porsche is because of their construction in the fatherland of mm-hmm. Stuttgart. And if they made them somewhere else, especially in China, it would dilute the brand and it wouldn't be the same. So good for them.
Yes, agreed. Good for them. They're absolutely right. It would lose some of the allure that a Porsche carries, I think.
Oh yeah. Well, you would have, you know, the word on the street would be, you know, the Chinese Porsche are junk, and you know, the German ones are the good ones, and mm-hmm. it could go in a whole bunch of different directions. Plus the fact that we've all heard the horror stories of manufacturing something exclusive in China, which no longer becomes exclusive, you know, because you got to work with the government, which doesn't really pay a lot of attention to intellectual property at this point and those rights, and your stuff could be instantly knocked off and you know, dilute it even further. So
right. Then you have cars that look like 911s but have Chinese emblems on them.
Right. Yeah. And you know, a lot of this stuff for me is kind of hearsay because I've not been there and I haven't experienced it. But I've heard stories, and if it's true or not, it's a pretty good story. But that certain manufacturing plants would make the legit goods for, you know, company X during the day, and then the second shift would run the exact same assembly line, but they'd all go knockoff. They were all black market.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the arrangement was like, no, you only, you know, leased this facility, or we gave you permission to operate in, you know, 9 to 5, and then the second shift comes in and runs them for something else. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Again, I don't know if it's true, but who knows?
It wouldn't shock me.
No. So another interesting piece of information is the Super Snake 66 Cobra 427 dual supercharged car is coming up for auction once again.
Really?
Yes. And I believe we talked about this in a previous episode of V8 Radio.
We did, yeah.
Yeah, because it sold the last time at Bear Jackson in 2015. Uh-huh. And it went for $5.5 million with the juice at that point.
Mm. Just imagine what it's going to go for now with prices the way they are. They're just out of control.
It seems that way. And that particular car was Carroll Shelby's personal Cobra.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole bunch of stories about this car, and a lot of them I don't think are right, which is just kind of how things go. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying I have all the right answers either by any stretch, but the interesting thing for this one is that it's a 427 with two superchargers, made like 900 horsepower. It's an automatic.
Mm.
It's got a C6 Ford automatic 3-speed behind it. And
you're
think
kidding.
I don't think any of the 4 speeds of the time were really up for that much power in a supercharged application, because it probably came on like a, you know, like a cannon.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
And Carroll drove that thing around, and there's a famous story of him driving it to Vegas. There was an open road race kind of thing from L.A. to Vegas, and he blew it up on the side of the road.
No kidding.
And famously just got out and walked away.
Oh, wow.
and hitchhiked with one of the other competitors and left it there. And, of course, eventually they sent the team back to pick the thing up, and they got it back. And this particular car ended up changing hands a few times. Now, at one point, and this is true, Carroll was driving his supercharged Cobra, and he encountered his friend Bill Cosby while out grocery shopping, and he gave Cosby a bunch of crap about Cosby driving a Ferrari. And Cosby said, "Well, look, when you build a 200-mile-an-hour Cobra, I'll buy one." And Shelby told the guys down in Torrance to build another one because that car was capable of that kind of speed. Mm-hmm. So Bill Cosby got the other one.
I remember Bill Cosby having that.
Yeah, and I think he did a whole comedy record routine about it, and it scared the hell out of him, so he got rid of it. And that one, the Cosby car, apparently went up north in California to the San Francisco Bay Area, where a gentleman bought it. And the story is that this guy got pulled over and finished up his his time with the police officer and was angry. So he floored it and took off down the road, and apparently the throttle stuck and he went over a cliff and the car ended up in the ocean, and ended up perishing, which wasn't good. And they eventually took the remains of the car and shipped it to England, where the cage was sort of salvageable, but it got reskinned and put back together, and it exists again, but not in the twin supercharged version. Somebody said it's got turbos on it now. Somebody else also said it's carbureted or whatever. So, so that one isn't really the original car anymore. The blue one, that was the black one. The blue one that Shelby had certainly does exist in its original form. And the interesting story behind that one is in about 1970, apparently Shelby sold it to singer-songwriter Jimmy Webb.
Is that right?
Yes. And I have a, I don't know if I've ever told the Jimmy Webb story on this podcast that I have, but
you may have.
Jimmy had the car up until the 90s, and he wrote a song about it, and really loved the car, and it went away. It he didn't have it anymore, right?
Didn't he lose it in a divorce or something?
Well, so that's what he told me.
You did tell me this story before.
Yeah. So
I'm so great.
So I'm a big Jimmy Webb fan, and for those who don't know who Jimmy Webb is, he wrote Wichita Lineman and By the Time I Get to Phoenix and Galveston and a whole bunch of, you know, kind of American standard classic songs. You know, Glenn Campbell recorded a lot of them. Everybody recorded them. And he was making a bunch of money by 1970 with royalties and whatnot. And so he bought this car. Well, by the early 2000s, I guess, he was still around. In fact, he's still around today. And he was performing his own songs, which was, you know, unusual for most people because they're so used to hearing Glenn Campbell and whatever.
Sure.
And Jimmy, Kelly and I were living in the Chicago area right as we were starting our VATV Productions television business. And Jimmy was coming to a theater, a small theater, 300 people or so, called Piper's Alley. And yeah, Kelly got tickets for us to go meet him and go see the show. So I was super excited about it. And it was wintertime, and we drove down there and saw the show, and I knew all the songs, and it was a great performance. You know, it was very cool. And Webb was signing stuff afterwards. He had a little autograph session, and I had the forethought to find something. You know, I was thinking about bringing something. I wasn't quite sure, but I found this picture of him in a Cobra, which, you know, I now know was the Super Snake car, and the picture was probably from the late 70s. I didn't know it was the Super Snake at the time. I just thought it was him in a Cobra. So, actually, I did not have, I saw the picture, but I didn't have it with me. So I didn't really know he was going to be signing autographs. But we get in line, and we finally get up to him, and I said, "Mr. Webb, it's, you know, an absolute pleasure to meet you. I've been a huge fan forever." And he said, "Do you have something to sign?" And I said, "Well, you know, not really." And he goes, "Well, do you have the concert ticket stub from tonight?" And I said, "That I do." And I gave it to him, and he says, "What's your name?" I said, "Kevin." And he said, "All right." He writes, like, "Best wishes, Kevin, you know, whatever." Yeah. And I said, "You know, actually, I found this picture, and I should have printed it out and brought it because I'm a car guy, and it's you in this really cool Shelby Cobra." And he just looks up at me, and he says, "Yeah, I lost that in a divorce." Next. So I'm thinking, oh, man. Right. You know, there's a saying about, you know, don't meet your heroes because, you know, it could be a letdown. Well, right. I certainly let this guy down. So we fast forward a couple of years, and now I'm living, Kelly and I are living in the St. Louis area where we live now. And sure enough, Jimmy comes back to town, and he's going to perform at an even smaller club. And we get tickets again. We go see him. Great show. And sure enough, he's out signing autographs, but he's also selling his latest CD. He had a new live disc. And I'm standing in line, and he holds up his CD, and he says, "Here, you want to buy one of these?" And I'm not a cash guy, and I certainly wasn't at the time. I'm all plastic. Right. And there's no ATM or anything around, you know. And I look at my wallet. I'm like, man, I got nothing. You know, I was going to go try and find an ATM or something. And he said, "You know what? You can have this. This is for you." And he just gave me his CD. And I'm like, wow, that is so cool. And I said, "You know."
How could I ruin this moment?
Yeah, well, I'm good at that. These people who listen to this show have lots of ruined moments. I said, you know, in Chicago a couple of years ago, I saw you at Piper's Alley, and you know, I'm a car enthusiast, and I asked you about this this Cobra, and you know, and he looks at me and he said, and you had to bring it up again. And at that point, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm just about ready to jump off a cliff. You know, how much of a bigger jerk could I have been?
Thanks for the CD, Jimmy.
I know, exactly. I still got it. And the signed ticket and everything. Didn't pay for it. And I'm pouring salt in his wounds over his long-lost love of a car.
You had to bring it up again.
Yeah. Well, as I'm telling the story today, I'm realizing something else. And if you're a guy like Jimmy Webb, you probably don't lose cars in divorces, right? I mean, you probably have enough resources to buy the car out of the divorce.
You would hope.
You would hope. And even, that car went for $5.5 million a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But in the time period he's talking about, you know, maybe the 90s, was it worth $5.5 million? No. It was still worth money, but maybe not that much. But I didn't think about that. I took him, you know, face value. Well, just today, as a matter of fact, I learn what I believe to be the actual history of that car.
Is that right?
Yeah. So he indeed bought it in 1970 and had it for a long time. But unfortunately, our friend, you know, at least, you know, he doesn't think I'm his friend, but Mr. Webb got into some tax trouble with the IRS.
Oh, no.
And that's where the car went.
Get out of here.
So he did lose it, but he didn't lose it in a divorce. It was confiscated, essentially, and sold at an auction in Los Angeles.
Jimmy.
He did everything he could to shield this asset from the IRS, and it apparently languished in a restoration shop for anywhere between 17 and 20 years that it was kind of off the grid. But they found it, and you know, when he was on troubled times, and I don't know anything about the IRS tax situation story. I know similar stories of musicians who get in trouble because of, you know, contract deals and stuff. They, you know, somebody mismanaged their money, whatever. I don't know anything about that. And I'm not, you know, trying to cast any dispersions on him for that. But it was interesting to me that he told me he lost it in a divorce when in reality, the IRS confiscated it. And the story was that the guy that owned the restoration shop that was hiding this car may have, well, he kind of gave him up, you know, and said he had the car. But I think he was thinking with an IRS asset auction, a lot of times if you bring it to them, you get first dibs, right? So maybe this guy thought, yeah, you know, I got the car, but my name's now on the list, right? You know, I get kind of first right of refusal. And the IRS, you know, quickly turned around and said, yeah, well, if you're the highest bidder. So apparently the IRS ran a full page ad in the LA Times promoting this car in this auction. And it sold for like, I don't know, 300 grand or something, 295 or something. Oof. In 1995. So that guy lost. Jimmy lost. Everybody lost.
Everyone
I lost
in this deal.
Yep. But you can win it at Barrett Jackson next month.
Nice. Nice. You hear that, Jimmy?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. Home.
Wouldn't it be wild to see him there bidding on his car?
Oh, that would be great, as a matter of fact.
Wouldn't it suck to lose your car to the IRS and have to pay millions to get it back?
Yep. Yes, it would.
Yeah. So when it sold in 15, I was displaying for Muscle Car of the Week at Barrett Jackson. And I watched it go across the block, and our good friend Charlie Lillard was actually bidding on the car.
Is that right?
Perhaps for the Brothers Collection.
Perhaps.
But it did not end up there, so maybe it will this time.
Fit again.
I don't know.
Oh, that would be something. That would be a heck of a feature for Muscle Car of the Week.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. If that happened, you know, I would have to, well, I'd have to have you call Jimmy Webb.
And I would do that for you.
Because he ain't going to show up if I call.
Well, I would say if Jimmy Webb won it again, you'd have to make it a point to find him. Say, hey, Jimmy, got the car back, huh, buddy?
Right. Yeah. I'm your good luck charm, Jimmy.
Yeah. See, Jimmy? See?
Yeah. Oh, man. It's a bummer because I really dig the guy. I like his music. I like interviews with him. He's just a solid guy, and I'm a jerk. So
I'm a jerk. Oh man.
So that was interesting. Another quick piece of news, the 2021 Mustang Mach 1 is coming out and is actually available at dealers, and it's a pretty interesting car. It's got a 480 horsepower Coyote V8 in it, which, to the dismay of many Mustang fans and Shelby fans, everybody was hoping that the flat plane crank 5.0 or 5.3 Voodoo engine was the one that was going to end up in the Mach 1.
Oh, yeah.
But apparently the Voodoo flat plane crank motor is done.
Really?
Yeah. And we had talked our last episode about the Cadillac Blackwing engine that is also out of production. Well, the Voodoo apparently made it from, what, 16 to 2020 or so in the GT350 cars. Mm-hmm. And that was 580 horsepower. But it is no more. So the Mach 1 is a nice car. You know, originally the Mach 1 concept was an appearance package and some luxury items added to a Mustang. It wasn't necessarily the highest performance version. Mm-hmm. And the new one is kind of similar. It's got a stripe package and it's got, you know, seats, and it does have a handling package that was available and a manual transmission and stuff. It's a good looking car. They you know, again, retroed some of the earlier design cues. And it's like $58,000, I think, with the handling package.
Huh.
So that's another one that I won't be buying, but it's it'll be cool to see.
I won't be buying that one too. How about right. that? Oh man, so I'm kind of confused. I mean, admittedly, I don't keep up with a lot of Ford stuff, but I thought the Mustang became that like electric kind of crossover looking.
The Mach-E?
The Mach-E, yeah.
Yeah, the Mach-E is its own vehicle.
Okay.
So the Mustang continues on, and the Mustang brand was extended to the Mach-E.
Oh.
And if you look at the Ford landscape, they're really only selling two cars anymore. They've got the Mustang, and they've got the Fusion, I believe, yeah. But they've got a few SUVs, and I think they, and we had talked about this before too, I don't think they thought that the electric SUV would have caused quite a stir if it was, you know, named the Ford Electric Edge.
Right.
Or whatever. What do we call that? We came up with a good name for that.
Yeah, you did. Oh, gosh, it was catchy.
Yeah. So so they badged it Mustang, but they didn't terminate the Mustang.
Okay.
Gasoline two-seat cars. So that's, or, you know,
I guess they made that assumption once they came out with the Mustang Mach-E. That was the Mustang from that point on.
Well, and that's really interesting feedback, because I don't know if they considered that. You know, a lot of people might have thought that the Mustang, as they knew it, was dead and buried, and then this was the only option. So,
yeah, it didn't even occur to me that it could be, you know, it could separate like that.
Yeah, that's kind of a whoopsie. Like
crazy.
Yeah.
See, the show's educational, folks.
It is. Yeah. That's a PR problem right there. It's,
I'd say so.
Yeah, well. Well, we'll have to call somebody.
Yep.
Have them whip up some commercials.
Yeah, I'm looking at the picture of this Mach 1. Looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it comes in good colors, and it's got the stripe and everything. And
yeah.
It'll be neat.
Yeah, for sure.
Changing gears yet again. Like I said, we got a lot of ground in this particular show. I was texting with my friend Manny the other day.
Okay.
And Manny is a guy who has become a really good friend, started off as a customer at our V8 Speed and Resto shop. And he's a huge car guy. He likes G-bodies. He's had, at one point, he had, I think, an 83 Oldsmobile 442 with like 13,000 miles on it. Just
nice.
Mint example. And he sold that and bought a Grand National. That was another, you know, very nice low mile car. He had a WS6 Trans Am with a built motor and a supercharger and a whole bunch of stuff on it that I think they overbuilt a little bit. It was a little more than he expected when it was all said and done. And then he had a Le Mans. I think he had a GTO. But the one he came to us with was that 78 Pontiac Trans Am SE car that we did the fast EFI conversion and the roller cam and did the video series.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's always good to chat with Manny. And that was like 4 years ago, maybe 4.5 years ago. We haven't worked on anything of his in a while because he's been kind of just enjoying what he has and kind of laying low. But the other problem that our buddy Manny had, unfortunately, was he got sick. And he had a bout with the big C with some cancer, and he beat it, which was great. But it was a process. I mean, it took a lot out of him. So he hadn't had a whole lot of time to enjoy his cars. But he texts me, you know, every once in a while, and we talk about stuff. And Manny's one of those guys who you can just talk cars with, you know. And he's super excited to talk about cars. And at one point, we were talking about, he was all excited. We were talking about building a Kiss van for him. Cause I had seen Jeff Allison, the illustrator, released some van thumbnails and sketches online. And one of them was a Trans Am nose on a van. And I'm like, oh, that's super cool. And another one was a van with the Eddie Van Halen Frankenstein guitar, you know, red, white, and black color scheme all over it. And the van was called Eruption, you know, it was really great theme vans. And I showed him to Manny and he's like, oh dude, we need to do a Kiss van. You know, so you have those conversations. He had another really cool one. He wanted to do a Pontiac 2+2, like an 86.
Yeah.
But with the Trans Am shaker hood and the bird instead of the stripes.
I'm on board with that.
Wouldn't it be awesome?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I tried to ruin it for him by telling him it had to be an LS.
Kevin,
instead of
no.
A 301 Pontiac at 140 horsepower or whatever was in it.
You could build it up.
Yeah. Well, you know, 455 or something.
Yeah.
You know, cool Pontiac motor. So the takeaway was Manny always gets excited about cars and this kind of stuff. And it kind of made me think this past year really, you know, was tough on everybody because the events were all canceled and, you know, we all know what didn't happen. But I found myself getting excited, you know, right along with them. And I thought to myself, this is interesting. You know, are there still things in the car world that, that I get excited about? And right now I think my brain is in kind of self-preservation mode where it's not letting me get excited about events because of the fear that it's going to get canceled.
I am right there with you on that.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, I'm like Lucy and Charlie Brown with the football. You know, I don't want to.
Yeah, right. Now you're going to hold it there, right? You're not going to take it away, right? No,
right.
I'm going to hold it there.
Yeah.
Go ahead, kick the ball.
And it just gets pulled away.
Yep.
So I was thinking, you know, maybe what are the, it'd be kind of cool to talk about maybe the top five things that that really, you know, would get you wound up, even to this day, having been involved with the car world for so long. So that's what I posed to you in a text saying, hey, you know, why don't we hit on our personal top five of cool car things that we get excited about.
Dig it. And I happen to have a top five list.
Right on.
Well, maybe I did my homework.
That's outstanding.
Yeah.
Maybe hit me with the top five or the number five. Let's go
number five. All right. My number five is what gets me jazzed is merely the fact that I own a cool classic car.
That would do it.
Yep. Since I was a little kid and I first saw that picture of my dad's 65 GTO, I've always wanted a cool car like that. And I remember when I was in the Air Force, I told myself, listen, kid, before you're 21, you need to own a GTO. And
before you're 21, you threw the gauntlet down.
Yeah, I did, and I did it when I was 19.
Nice.
And just scrounged one up. That first 67 post car I had, and they had a 455 in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved owning it. I absolutely loved it. And even when I traded it for my 66 Sprint 6 Le Mans, and I loved that car. Prettiest car I ever owned. And it just, I get jazzed by the fact that I still have a 67 GTO today that I got from my dad. And I remember when I didn't have that car, when I had no cool car, you know, I'm just kind of bummed because mm-hmm. I know guys that have it. I'm like, man, I need a cool car again. This is enough. I need it. So yeah, so owning a classic is my number five.
That's a great one, and it's it's something that kind of in the spirit of this whole little exercise, that's something I take for granted for sure. I'm lucky that got a couple of cool cars in Kelly's truck, mm-hmm. her 54 Chevy, you know, to me, they're such a part of my life that I'm always thinking about what I'm going to do next or what needs to be fixed or when I can drive it. And I don't really step back and go, you know what, this is really kick-ass.
Yeah, it is kick-ass.
It is. Mm-hmm. And hopefully others that, you know, someday want a cool car and don't have one yet can find a way to make it happen because it's... It has its source of joy and gratification and frustration and tears and all the rest.
It's all that.
Yeah, right on. All right. Well, my number five is a kind of different from that one, but it's I love watching racing when you know the racer's stories.
Mm.
That gets me. Cool. Totally wound up. I mean, I like racing anyway. You know, yeah. I'll watch anything. If there's two of them, let's race. I don't care what the heck it is. But when I was covering the NMCA for Hot Rod Television and I got to know most of those guys in the Super Street class and the Pro Street class and Real Street, and I knew the backstory, like, oh man, this motor didn't exist, you know, 2 weeks ago, and they all thrashed and drove from Indiana to get here to Bowling Green, and oh my gosh, and mm-hmm. and they're racing this guy, and he was, you know, he lost his car in a fire and had to sell his business and built another one. And once you learn all that backstory, the race becomes personal, and you really feel that connection, and you're rooting for him like crazy. Exactly. And I never forget, we would hire a local cameraman in different cities. Because it was a you know, cheaper thing to do, and they knew the area, so it was a better deal. But some of these camera guys, to them, it was just a day of work. You know, what are we shooting today? Oh, we're going to a racetrack. Okay, great. And here's me on the sideline, you know, mm-hmm. with fists clenched and you know, shortness of breath and all wound up, you know, watching this race. And the cameraman's like, "What's the deal?" You know,
You know these guys.
Yeah, I have to tell them the whole story, you know, of why this is cool. And the fun thing is most of those camera guys and production assistants and everybody else, they were all on board by the end of the weekend too. You know, we're all watching the final rounds and, mm-hmm. and you know, half the time they're supposed to be shooting the video on it and instead they're watching it, you know. So watching racing where you don't know the people, and that's why NASCAR tries to do so much to develop the personality of these racers, you know, so that you connect with them on some level.
You definitely become emotionally involved with this race and their plight to get there. Like you said, you know, the guy blew his motor up, you know, in 2 weeks ago, and he had to get it built from scratch, had to replace the block and get everything taken care of and all that, and you feel it. You start, because if you have any kind of empathy in you at all, you definitely feel that for that person. You're like, oh man, I want you to win this so bad now.
Right. And especially because, you know, many of us know how hard it is when you break an engine, you know, car goes in the garage. It might be a couple of years before it comes out again.
Ouch, baby. Very ouch.
It wasn't a dig. It was just, a little bit of the reality of being a car guy. So anyway, that's my number five, racing when you know the racer stories.
Cool. All right. My number four is I still love going to car shows and cruise nights and hanging out and
right
seeing
on.
Cool cars go by. Love it.
That is cool. Something I miss doing.
Yeah, I didn't get to do it at all last summer, obviously. Looking forward to it this summer. Our local town of Plainfield, Illinois, they have a nice downtown area where they hold a cruise night on Tuesday nights. And it's on the way home from work, so I'll invariably just stop there on my way home, and I'll walk a few laps of the streets and check everything out and talk to a few people and just take it all in.
Well, and, you know, you'll have the GTO on the road, so, you know, you'll be the king of the Tasty Freeze before too long.
That's right.
It's going to be awesome.
It will be awesome. King of the Tasty Freeze. I'm going to have that painted on there.
You'll be back to being a participant, which is
right,
more than just a spectator. So that's good.
Yeah.
Well, my number four is kind of similar. It's I get jazzed up about cars that you don't normally see, but then when you finally see one in person.
Mm.
So I dig just about everything. I'm fortunate that at our shop, I get to see a lot of really great cars. But for example, we had a customer with a 58 Edsel, and it was turquoise, and it was a column shift bench seat two-door Edsel, and you never see those cars.
No.
And this thing rolls in, and I was just looking at this thing all over the place, looking at the interior and the gauges and the trim on the dash and under the hood and the way things fit together and all that stuff. And it was really, really cool because the car is so different and it looks so different, but it was a chance to see another angle of how things were done that I'm not used to. You know, I know every part of a 69 Camaro inside and out, you know,
right.
But on a 58 Edsel, it's all kind of different. So I get wound up when I get to see something that is really unusual and I get to spend time with it and really check it out.
Dig it. I like that. Yeah. Going along the lines with going to cruise nights, it's really cool to see something you don't see a lot of. Or, you know, you're used to seeing all your main players, your Mustangs, your Camaros, your Chevelles, your GTOs, your 442s. But when you see that real oddball, there was one guy had, what was it, like a 40-something Mercedes that was at a cruise night. And it was beautiful.
Yeah.
And was it a Mercedes or a Rolls-Royce? I think it was a Rolls-Royce. I'm sorry. But he was just arriving in style, and he brought it to a few cruise nights a few years ago. And, you know, I went there, I'd look for it, like, because it's so unique. Nothing mm-hmm. else, nothing else there like it.
Yep, that's cool.
Yeah. So, okay. So moving on, my number three would be, I love, when my GTO is running, I love just tinkering with it. Trying to, you know, change a little something here and there. The gauge cluster in there didn't have the tack in it, so I wanted to see if I could kind of not just like put the tack on the steering column, but I wanted it inside the gauge and not just shove down the tack hole to be sticking out. So I actually took the gauge cluster out. I removed the can where the clock was. And I kind of hobbled together the tack behind there, so it's behind the lens, and it doesn't look out of place. And just doing stuff like that, just making little changes, little improvements, just kind of makes me happy to
That's cool.
do that.
That is great.
Yeah.
Those are gratifying projects, especially when they go well.
Yeah.
Interestingly, my number three is very similar.
Is that right?
Except I called it weekend garage projects.
Mm.
And, you know, to kind of define that, I really dig a project like what you're talking about that you can plan out and that you can set the time aside. You know, maybe it's not this coming weekend, but the following, you know, so you got time to get ready and get your tools together and get your parts and get the garage organized and cleaned and, you know, clear the time, and you can look forward to it all week. Protect the time. Exactly.
That's right.
and get in on, you know, right away early Saturday morning. And if it's a 2-day thing, you know, you finish it up Sunday night and you wash your hands and go, this is done. And I did it. And hopefully it works.
Yeah, no doubt.
But that's a great example of that kind of project, you know, and there's seeming, even if it's maintenance, you know, maintenance or you were doing the timing belt on your daily driver, you know,
right.
That's a great, you know, could be a long weekend project because mm-hmm. it's not something you do every day, but
right.
at the end, you know, you were texting me saying, hey, check it out.
Yeah. I sent you a small snippet of Fun with Cars.
That's right. A couple episodes of Fun with Cars.
That's right.
By Q-Ball. We'll have to put those up on the YouTube channel.
Yeah, right. Today on Fun with Cars.
That's right.
Oh, man. Okay, my number two here is kind of an oddball thing, but it's just one of those things that kind of gives me a visceral reaction to, and that's the smell of classic car exhaust.
Ooh.
It's kind of hard to define, but it's different. I mean, there's some unburned hydrocarbons. It has a distinct odor that really kind of takes me back to my youth when you smell that a lot with cars that were on the road. I mean, today's cars burn so cleanly, you know, and it's a good thing that they burn cleanly and they don't stink up the place.
Mm-hmm.
But that classic car exhaust smell, it really is, I find something so pleasing about it. It's hard to explain.
Well, it's true. I know exactly what you're talking about, obviously. And it's, you know, when a carbureted car first starts up, it runs rich and it has that smell. You know, once they warm up, if they're in tune, they don't really have quite
right.
that much of that smell. I think gasoline is different today. So I think it smells a little different mm-hmm. than it used to. You might have been talking about regular gasoline back then, leaded.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, if you're sniffing that it might explain a few things.
So many variables, Kevin, so many.
Yeah. But that's a good smell. And you know, a lot of people are really taken with the smell of you know, really high-octane race gas.
Mm, yeah.
In fact, a lot of people burn that stuff just because of the smell.
I see.
Which is not a good idea.
Yeah.
It's another story.
Yeah, if it's not meant for it, it's probably you shouldn't do it.
But. Well, you know, a lot of times it's hard for the, unless you have a really high compression engine and mm-hmm. and a really robust ignition system, a lot of times that stuff won't light off and you'll be driving around and it'll be stumbling and misfiring and you'll be chasing timing and, you know, fuel pressure and it's all fine, but the car doesn't run right and it's because that gas is too hard to light being really high octane.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
And they used to sell cologne for your gasoline. I don't know if they still do this. Yeah, it was bottles of stuff that you could pour in the tank, and it would change the smell of gasoline to like blueberry and different fruits and stuff. You could get it at Jegs, I think. I gotta look that up.
Me.
No, it was a real thing.
Huh.
I don't know why, but it was a real thing.
It's hysterical.
Yeah.
They
have a bottle of stuff. I'll get you some. It's called, it's Mike's Youth.
Mike's Youth. Yeah. Nice.
You pour it in there, it just takes you right back.
Oh, I love it. I love it. That's great stuff. All right.
All right.
So
well,
my number one here on this list.
Well, hold on. I got to do my number two.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm hogging the mic here.
That's all right. Hopefully my number two isn't number two. So for me, my number two thing that gets me excited and jazzed up is when a car is just going into the paint booth.
Ah.
Because at that point, especially in our world at V8 Speed and Resto, if we're painting a car, it's taken a while to get there because we did a lot of metal work, a lot of body work, and a lot of time was put into making this thing, you know, wet sanding and getting it refined. And so it's a culmination of all kinds of work and care and detail that has an immediate change as soon as it gets color on it, you know. So you're always excited to see what the color looks like when it lays out,
oh, yeah.
Covering up that you know, light gray sealer coat. But at the same time, it's high risk. There's many opportunities to screw up a car in the paint booth. And fortunately, I mean, super fortunately, our painter, Jeff, doesn't screw up in the paint booth.
Well, that's good.
I've painted enough cars and screwed enough of them up to know that if you don't know what you're doing, you can do little amateur mistakes like drag the air hose across a freshly painted panel and screw it up that way. You can have your air pressure wrong and your metallics don't lay out right. You could have mixed your paint and it doesn't cure properly, or it runs, or the panel-to-panel color match is wrong, or you can zebra stripe it. I mean, there's a lot of ways to screw up a paint job. And in our shop, we don't have that problem, which is phenomenal. Just, you know, the talent level is unbelievable, especially over, you know, awesomely done body work, and it's just nice and crisp and straight. And so the first stage of that is when the car goes in and you hit it with the initial color, and that's the base coat. And base coats are flat, basically satin, no matter what color they are, even if it's a metallic color. And those are the ones that are really magic, because the next level of excitement is when you shoot the first coats of clear on them. And all of a sudden they get all this depth, and the car shines, and you can see how straight the panels are, and the reflections are there, and you know, it's really, really cool. So I get super excited when it's time to spray the car.
Oh, that's killer. Yeah, I bet that first layer clear, that really tells the tale. Really, you can't hide behind anything.
No.
You got that.
And, you know, that's not to say that, you know, little things haven't gone wrong in the booth.
Sure.
Generally, we don't have color problems. But there's an occasional, you know, run in the clear, you know, here and there. Those are very fixable. Yeah. You know, you can sand those out and buff them, and it's like it never happened. So, but it looks so awesome to see, you know, cause the rest of the car is still masked up, and it's just this big solid form of whatever this new shiny color is. It's just cool.
That is cool. Yeah. I'd like to experience that sometime. That'd be neat.
Yeah, we should come down.
I should come down. This damn pandemic, Kevin. I can't go anywhere. I'm on lockdown.
Well, you know, soon, not in the next month or so, but sometime probably by spring, late spring, early summer, we're going to be spraying a 65 Tempest convertible. So you have to come down for that.
Was it that one we saw when Paul and I were down there?
Yeah. We did a bunch of work, a bunch of metal work, did some Kindig handles on it, and fixed the quarters and stuff. And then when it was getting ready to go through bodywork and paint, and the pandemic hit, and the customer said, no, let's shelve this project for a little while because I'm not sure what's going to happen, and put it in storage.
Huh.
But he has since seen that the world didn't end, you know, thankfully, for him financially either. So he wants us to get back on it. So we're just going through the rotation of all the rest of the cars that are in that department to bring it back and get it into bodywork. So,
and when's that going to happen again?
It's not yet back in the shop, being worked on yet, but it's basically metal worked and it's been epoxied, and we have to start. No, it's had some bodywork done to it too. It's got, you know, it's been block sanded and some filler work has been done. So as soon as it gets in the shop, it's going to be probably another 2 months or so before it gets sprayed. So I'll let you know when it arrives, and we'll schedule it out.
For sure. Yeah, I'd love to see that. Cool. Mm-hmm. Please don't forget.
I won't.
All right. And that brings us to my number one thing I still get jazzed about with car stuff. And that would be when if I'm out and about, and I just see somebody driving their cool classic car just kind of out in the wild. Not in a parade, not at a car show. Just driving on the street, using it, and doing stuff with it.
And that is cool.
I absolutely love it. Because in a world of cars that look like appliances these days, to see something with a lot of character and great lines and great looks driving down the road, and you hear it, you see it, It's his own car. It's just, it's fantastic. There's few things I get more jazzed about than that.
That is really cool because it's also a surprise.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, you're driving home half asleep and just trying to pay attention to the road and mm-hmm. all these. There's a Police song. I guess it's Synchronicity too. Packed like lemmings into shiny metal boxes.
Yes.
Contestants in a suicidal race.
Yes.
You know, and all of a sudden, you know, a 58 Buick pulls out in front of you, and you're like, "Wow, look at that! Yeah.
That is awesome."
That is cool.
Yeah, that really gets my attention. So,
especially around here, because, you know, in the Chicago area, you do see quite a bit of them in the summertime.
Yes.
And on weekends and nice days and stuff like that. But there's still a lot of those cars just driving around in the Southwest that are just cars. And it's neat to see them. They're more common there. So I love to visit, you know, my mom in Scottsdale in Arizona and see these things just cruising around, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, super cool.
Yeah. I'm on board with that.
Dig it.
All right, so my number one car-related thing that I get excited about, I have to say it's the SEMA show.
Mm. How could it not be?
Because the SEMA show, to me, is everything all at once. So it's awesome cars that are built to the top level. It's all the new parts and cool new stuff. Mm-hmm. It's events and activations throughout the week. It's the nightlife. It's travel. It's going to Vegas. Mm-hmm. It's positive energy of a great industry where, you know, people are just trying to do their best to succeed. And on top of all that, the biggest thing is it's the people, you know, mm-hmm. and seeing other people in the industry that I've known for a long time and meeting new ones. And the icing on the cake is that I get to actually work there and do fun stuff and interview people and, mm-hmm. and you know, get quality time with people that I normally wouldn't. So that, you know, I get excited a month ahead of time for that one. So.
No, for sure. I mean, I loved being able to go to the SEMA show that one time. That was a dream. That really was.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget it.
No, and I'm seeing today that the Vegas Convention Center has constructed another hall. There's a whole new building. It's huge. And I remember talking with the VP of events, Tom Gattuso, a couple of years ago, I guess it was 19, about how the 2020 show was going to be challenging because the main walking routes to get to and from some of the show halls were going to be closed as they built this new hall. And they weren't sure how to manage traffic and, you know, do all this stuff. Well, that turned out to not be a problem.
Yeah, it sure didn't.
But luckily, the crews are plowing ahead and actually getting this convention center finished. And Tom had the plan already figured out for how they would populate the new hall even back in 19. So he knew where it was going to go. He just didn't know what was going to happen in the interim.
Gotcha.
So they've got plans to fill that whole thing out too. And that's going to be really, really, really awesome. So you'll have to get back out there for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely want to get back out there. I have a couple of honorable mentions here on this list as well.
No, right on.
Yeah, I mean, one of them is I just like talking to other people about their projects and mm-hmm. what they're doing and how they see things panning out and the themes that they choose for their particular project. I dig hearing others talk about that. It you know, it can give you ideas about what you might want to do to yours and say, you know, I like that interior treatment he did, or I like how the stance he put on his car, I like the suspension he's using. I want that for mine. So just kind of getting out there and talking and, you know, you get some ideas and you're able to convey your thoughts to them and maybe they get ideas. So mm-hmm. that's kind of fun.
And that kind of goes along with getting back to my buddy Manny, because
right.
the KISS van might not be something that I want to build, but when you see somebody else get all excited about it, it's contagious.
I'm excited about it. Yeah. I love custom vans.
Well, I do too. I the Kiss would be kind of down the line. But he's seen Kiss, I think, 71 times or something crazy like that. Oh, I mean, wow. he's into it. So
he's got to have a Kiss fan then.
Yeah.
And my other honorable mention, and not to be self-serving, but co-hosting this podcast. I love right talking on. Cars and hanging out and doing that. And, you know, I've used this show has introduced me to new people and, like-minded individuals. And, you know, it's been a great experience. I mean, we've been plugging along at this for nearly 5 years, and it's been great. I look forward to every episode.
Well, so do I. Good to hear VA Radio getting a little love.
Right on.
And I really enjoy this. I think oftentimes, I don't know if I speak for you, but sometimes you can almost forget that we're recording this. We're just talking
sometimes.
About whatever. Our apologies to the listeners. But I think that kind of is what people dig about it. You know, it's not, we're not really putting on a show. You know, we're just, this is what we do. You know, we're just into it. And you're right. Almost 5 years. Holy mackerel.
5 years, almost 100 episodes.
Yeah. We got to do something special for the 100th. It's coming up.
Yeah.
I would say going back and editing a best of the last 100 episodes would be great, but boy, that's too big of a project.
That's a huge project. What I was thinking of is stringing along every overselling adjective we've used for every
that's
show
a great idea.
In the beginning.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And maybe some of the answers to the trivia questions, too, would be good.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. If anybody has any ideas...
Right. What do you want to hear on the 100th?
What's that?
What do you want to hear on the 100th?
Yeah, here on the 100th episode.
Yeah, cool. No, I dig your idea, the overselling adjectives. That's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, very, cool. Very cool. And speaking of that and the trivia questions, it's time, man.
It is time. All right. Let's reveal these answers. All right, Kevin, I asked you, what was the only car to ever break the sound barrier? And you said the Blue Flame in 1970. Well, I will tell you this. The Blue Flame did set an FIA world record in 1970 for the flying mile at 622 miles an hour.
But it wasn't fast enough.
It wasn't the fastest. The only car to ever break the sound barrier was a British car.
It was the Brits.
Called the Thrust SSC in
1998. Huh? I was going to guess 98. Yeah.
And it achieved a speed of 763 miles per hour.
There you go.
Becoming the first car to ever officially break the sound barrier.
Yeah. So I knew of it. I got it wrong. Kind of disappointed. I don't have land speed on the brain at this moment.
Yeah. The difference is the Blue Flame was a rocket-powered car,
right?
And the Thrust SSC is a jet-powered car.
Okay. Well, it is different. And I remember, you know, again, there's a big kind of friendly competition between us and the Brits to try and get that record back here in the States.
That's where it belongs.
Well, it belongs where the fastest car came
from.
Yeah,
that's true.
You know?
My apologies to any of our English friends.
Well, no, but I mean, again, it's cool to know the story. If you know the story behind it, it's that much more exciting.
Right.
All right, so my question to you was in 1963, Pontiac had this unique two-speed automatic rear-mounted transaxle that had the guts of a Chevrolet Power Glide. But, of course, Pontiac had to rename it. And what did they call it? Your guess was the Super Turbine 300.
That was my guess.
Which is a real General Motors transmission, by the way.
Yep. But it's not that one.
Correct. It is not that one.
Oh, so close. My winning streak snapped.
So the name of it was the Tempest Torque.
The Tempest Torque.
Yeah.
Oh, heavens to Betsy.
Which is not a common thing, you know?
No.
I don't think a lot of people knew that was called the Tempest Torque.
I don't think a lot of people did either.
Because if they did, you would hear that term like all the time. That's a cool term, a Tempest Torque. It's
is
a good
cool.
name.
But I think those cars are so few and far between, they just don't get any exposure or any love.
Right. I agree.
Ah, man. And I knew Super Turbine 300 was wrong when I said it, but that was the only one that was coming to mind. I knew it wasn't, obviously it wasn't a Power Glide. But I think that Super Turbine 300 was the two-speed transmission that, like your later model Le Mans or Tempest used.
I mean, yeah, that was
generically called it a Power Glide, but it really wasn't a Power Glide.
A BOP,
yeah,
pattern transmission. Was that also the Slim Jim?
Maybe.
I don't think so, actually. I think the Slim Jim's different. But in that era, 65, 6, 7, 8, something like that.
Yeah.
Well, we both lost, so.
So close. I'm stuck to two in a row. But that was nice. It was great while it lasted. I got to say, I was flying high there for a little bit.
Woo. Well, you were. I mean, that's, you know, all the more inspiration to continue on.
Yeah, but like Icarus, I flew too close to the sun. I came crashing down.
And that's all we have today on V8 Radio, friends. So, for Mr. Mike Cuball Clark, I'm Kevin Ostey, reminding you to not fly too close to the sun. And we will talk at you next time, right after you subscribe to V8 Radio.